The Free Library of Philadelphia is proud to present a podcast from our author event series, recorded live at the Central Library on the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. To learn more about the Free Library, the Central Library Expansion Project, and how your contribution can help our programs and services for the community, please visit freelibrary.org.
Thank you very much for coming out tonight with this threat of snow, they say. I've been on the road, and I got back in town, and it's just good getting back in town, sitting down in your house doing nothing, sitting in a rocking chair and just rocking. But this particular trip was really very interesting because Sister Camille Cosby has done this amazing collection of interviews with what she calls elders, and these are men and women who have just spent at least 65 to 70 years of doing work in this place called America. And so we were part of that at Spelman College with Ruby Dee, Jasmine Guy, and Jackie Joyner Kersey were the younger members. So we had a cross-generational discussion, and it was really... And in between that, we went and did a show with Monique, who is really a wonderful young woman. And really, she's proved to be a good actress, a good actor. And someone asked the question, who would have thought that a comedian could, do such straight, dramatic, very intense work? And I said, the thing about being a comedian is that on the other side of comedy is tragedy. It's right there waiting for you to look at and understand. So anyway, I got back home right in time for snow. And then they say snow again, so let us see. Let us try to, since this is Groundhog Day, right, let us try to simply say that we don't want any more snow and cold weather. There is a caption here from a woman by the name of Abby Lincoln in this new book who said, "The best thing you can do is to be a woman and stand before the world and speak your heart." So I greet a lot of people here, a lot of people I know, I'm looking at, I see. And I just want to begin by maybe reading just a little bit in this book called Hakuography, at the very beginning, and this is part taken from a longer essay that's going to be in a collection of my essays, talking about the intersection of the blues and the haiku. But if I put a 10-page essay at the beginning of a book of poetry, people would have been really uptight. And I know I'm uptight when I see stuff like that, so I just have 2 pages, but I'd like to just read it. "From the moment I found a flowered book high up on a shelf at the 8th Street bookstore in New York City, a book that announced Japanese haiku. From the moment I opened that book and read the first haiku, I slid down onto the floor and cried and was changed. I had found me. It's something to find yourself in a poem, to discover the beauty that I knew resided somewhere in my 21-year-old bloodstream. From the moment I asked the clerk in the bookstore if I was pronouncing this haiku word correctly, I knew that I had discovered me, had found an awakening, an awareness that I was connected not only to nature, but to the nature of myself and others. From the moment I saw the blood veins behind beautiful eyes, the fluids in teeth, and the enamel in tongues, I knew that haiku were no short-term memory, but a long memory. Patricia Donegan shares the idea of haiku mind, a simple yet profound way of seeing our everyday world and living our lives with the awareness of the moment expressed in haiku, and to therefore hopefully inspire others to live with more clarity, compassion, and peace. I knew when I heard young poets say in verse and conversation, 'I'm going to put you on pause,' I heard their haiku nature, their haikuography. They were saying, 'I gotta make you slow down and check out what's happening in your life, in the world.' So this haiku slows us down. makes us stay alive and breathe with that one breath that it takes to recite a haiku. This haiku, this tough form disguised in beauty and insight, is like the blues, for they both offer no solutions, only a pronouncement, a formal declaration, an acceptance of pain, humor, beauty and non-beauty, death and rebirth, surprise and life, always life. Both always help us to maintain memory and dignity. What I found in the A Street Bookshop was extraordinary and ordinary. Silence, crystals, cornbread and greens, laughter, brocades, the sea, Beethoven, Coltrane, spring and winter, blue rivers, dreadlocks, blues, a waterfall, empty mountains, bamboo, bodegas, ancient generals, lamps, fireflies, Sarah Vaughan, her voice exploding in the universe, returning to earth in prayer, plum blossoms, silk and still, Conte Hondo, wine, hills, flesh, perfume, a breath inhaled and held, silence, and I found that my mouth and the river are one and the same. I set sail in tall grass, no air stirs. You know, and belonging to the haiku society, that if you know what's happening with the American haiku, is that there are people writing now one-liners haiku, two-line haiku, three lines, and there are people also experimenting in a very real way with the haiku. For instance, the haiku that I did for Toni Morrison could not always sustain the sparse lines, and so therefore I put more into those lines because her work is complex, complicated, you know, those of you who study Morrison. So I made the haiku take on the form of her work. I hope you hear what I'm saying. And that was important, you know, so I stuffed it, you know, I decided to at some point say each line is really a haiku, you know, each line of the three liner is really a haiku. And that's what I did, for. And also I just wanted to say, you know, some of the stuff that I didn't put in the book, but you'll find out later on when you read my essay, is that one of the things that I wrote having fun with the haiku and the blues is that I, talked about there's no greed or excess in the haiku, you know? And I said that a haiku could be described as the pretty, sadiddy good girl hoping for a bad boy at night, and the blues is a fast, bad girl going out at night hoping for a good boy. Yeah, I'd love to mess with this thing called words, you know? Well, let's begin. And I like to begin with the one to Toni Morrison. 15 haiku for Toni Morrison. I'm going to start and say one, but you know it's three lines, so I'll stop. Saying the one, two stops the rhythm for me, okay? So just listen. And one of the things that I'm doing with the haiku, when I'm invited to go to a university, you know, the first thing I say to people is that, yeah, I'll come do your gig, but take me to a high school the next day for free. And I go into these high schools and I talk to our children and our grandchildren. And one of the things I'm attempting to do is to talk about this haiku mind. You know, talking about saying that we are ordinary and extraordinary. At the same time, we're bad and we're good. One of the things we do on this earth is that we all move towards the good. We try to make it like lean more towards the good, if you understand what I'm saying. You know, we're beautiful and ugly. You know it and I know it, right? You know, none of us is Jesus walking the streets, you know? And so at some point, we truly do understand that. And so, but I talk about leaning more towards the good than the bad. And that's what I do with the young people. And I talk about also, that means that if you're going to write a haiku, you must be very mindful. When you become mindful in writing this haiku, then you become mindful of yourselves. When you become mindful of yourselves, you save your lives. So one of the things that I did starting at a place called what is that university in Brooklyn where they have the big conference every year? Mega Evers. That one of the things that we do that I did there is that I did a gig there, and they brought the high school students to me. And so I read to them, and then there was a question, and the question was posed by a young 17-year-old Puerto Rican sister. She said to me, "Professor Sanchez, I am 17 years of age, and I want to live. Can you tell me what it is that you did to stay alive when you grew up in Harlem?" You know, that's a very profound question. You know, it's not E equals anything. You know, it's like life, you know, against death, which is the same thing if you truly understand formulas, you know? And I said, "Well, if I tell you, will you listen? Because I don't think that as an elder, I know every bloody thing on the planet Earth." And so they said, "Yes." And even some of the guys sitting in the back like this, like, you know, like, "What can you tell me?" kind of thing, you know, leaned forward because everybody wants to stay alive. I don't care who you be. Right? I know I teach English, but who you be is real. And I went and sat on the edge of the stage and told them what I did at 17 years of age, you know, to stay alive. And I got up and started to, you know, I was going to autograph some books. I brought some books for the high school students and autographed them some CDs. I went to go down the side of the steps and something stopped me and said, "You're not finished." I came back. And I walked towards the edge of the stage with my eyes closed, and the young people stopped and said, "Hold it." I said, "I know the edge is there." I said, "You know, I'm not going to ask you to survive. I'm going to insist that you survive. In fact," I said, "one year from today, I'm going to show up, and we're going to talk to each other and tell us how we all survived." You know, you see, I said, "Because this is going to be a contract with life with you, not death. And what we're talking about is that we who teach, we who are mothers, we who do whatever we do must begin to have a contract with life, not death, even with ourselves, with each other, you know, with our families also, too." And so I said, because one of the things you have to do, I said, I grew up in a place called Harlem, and I explained that. And everybody who knows me and the people who I grew up with knows that I had, in Harlem, you had to have a bad tongue to stay alive. I mean, you couldn't say hi. "My name is Sonia. How are you?" People like would wipe you out and step on you and kick you at the same time. So you get a bad tongue, if you understand. And a lot of my early poetry was a bad tongue, you know, like whatever. We told you exactly how to get there. But, you know, it doesn't change anything in the world. And I said to them today, "You can't have a bad tongue today because you can die from having a bad tongue. We came up at a time where, you know, we could stay alive. We stayed alive, whatever, because everybody liked having a bad tongue, playing the dozens with somebody, seeing somebody back away and get upset, you know, and you walk by and kick them. You know what I mean? But nowadays, people go home and get an Uzi, come back and go boom." And so I said, "Sometimes you have to step away to have another day. This is a contract with life, not death. This is a contract about life and breath." And that's what I've been doing. And it was amazing. I went 4 times to a place called Detroit, Michigan. 4 times, where the dropout rate is 80% in the high schools for blacks and Latinos, 80%. And they piped me in, and I didn't go in. The kids raised their hands like, "Who are you coming in to tell us anything? These teachers don't like us." I said, "I know." I said, "What you telling me? I went to a school in Harlem. None of the teachers liked us. What's new? Tell me what's new. What's new now in 2006? What's new? What was new in 1960-something? What's new? Nothing's new. The point is, but how do you react to it? And you think you're seditious by cursing somebody out, hitting them, banging them, whatever?" I said, "Let me teach you how to be really seditious. You know what that means? Let me tell you the meaning of seditious. You know how to become seditious? Let me tell you how to take over a class and get that teacher to teach you finally. That's been really seditious, staying in school." Have no idea how much our children, I mean all our children in these public schools, in all these places sometimes where they just know people don't like them, and so therefore they do this passive-aggressive thing, really. So that's what I do. That's why I come in whipped, because I tell you, that is hard work. Because I'm in the midst of talking, and one kid, and are there little children in here? So then I had one child, they said, you know, it rhymes with duck, you know, whatever, right? You got it? Okay. And I heard it and ignored it, you know. Some young person in the back said it louder, and the students, oh. So I came forward, you know, on the stage. I said, there's a camera, so I know I'm going to mess with you. You know, they probably love it. I hate being behind a stage, you know. I said, did you say duck? You know what I mean. You know, I said, who said it? Right? This kid got up, we're back. I said it, you know. I said, did you say duck? Or did you say duck, duck, duck? Did you say duck, 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 duck? And by the time I finished, it didn't mean anything. You know, the whole thing was just wiped out, whatever. And nobody was laughing again if he were to say it again, you know. But then I came off the stage because I didn't want to embarrass him and hugged him. And I said to him, thank you for helping me teach. Sometimes I forget, you know, that I'm a teacher behind the podium. Thank you for helping me to teach something that needed to be taught, you know. And he just smiled and was just as happy, you know, whatever. That's the whole point, you know. You don't ever embarrass people in a classroom, you know. Not at all. But anyway, I hope all of you are doing that work for our children, that is, saving their lives. Because what does it matter? And what would it matter if we who pass this way don't leave our children alive or dead mentally? 15 haiku for Toni Morrison. 1, we know so little about migrations of souls crossing oceans, seas of longing. We have not always been prepared for landings that held us suspended above our bones. In the beginning, there was we and they and others too mournful to be named, or brought before elders, even held in contempt. They were so young in their slaughterings. In the beginning, when memory was sound, there was bone smell, blood tear, whisper scream, and we arrived carrying flesh and disguise, expecting nothing, always searching for gusts of life and sermons, in the absence of authentic gods, new memory, in our escape from plunder, in our nesting on agitated land, new memory. In our fatigue at living, we saw mountains, cracking skulls, purple stars, colorless nights, trees praising our innocence, new territories dressing our lens in starched bones. In our traveling to we selves, in the building, in the journeying to discover our own deaths, in the beginning, there was a conspiracy of blue eyes to iron eyes, new memory falling into death. Oh, will we ever know what is no more with us? Oh, will we selves ever convalesce as we ascend into wave after wave of blood milk? That's a piece that I did for Sister Toni Morrison. And a piece called Memory Haiku, which is a piece I did about myself and about being born in a place called Birmingham, and about my mother dying in childbirth, giving birth to twins. 1, I was born a three-legged black child, carrying an extra leg for quick departures. Beneath the sun, I moved in short Birmingham breaths. Silence of the house. In the kitchen, someone washes the floor. Silence, no words, just the sound of earthquakes. Precocious morning, releasing an avalanche of blood. In the hospital, mother, you chanted complex half moons. What is it about childbirth that women ask for seconds? How long the night to break your body into a diabetic coma? How wild the gusts of blood running down hospital corridors. Do women make a living singing death prints? In my dreams, I rubbed your limbs until they sparkled. Wherever I am, I patrol your seasonal death. I bring you pine trees and laughter for your journey. Do you hear me singing in the mountains under a constant sky? I, a passerby to your death, cradle your breath. I, a sleepwalker to dreams, imagine you a crane flying south. Every day I hear your voice beyond the hills. And just listen, don't clap. That's the thing about the haiku. Listen. Listen to some of the words. Remember the words. Concentrate on some of the lines. Imagine some of the things that we imagine as we write these haiku. And this is called Sister Haiku for Pat, my sister. One, how many secrets you carried in your panties? Infections of confections, no retractions. The autumnal rain announced a sister's fragrance. Your slanted black eyes smile crystals. Can two little girls holding hands walk unnoticed in a large house? Young man home from war envies the subtle pause of young beauty. Disguised as uncle, he picked at your unbroken spine. How to moisten the silence of an afternoon molestation. Silk on your skin, no armor for the amputee. Birmingham eyes ignoring the winter's confinement. To be born, to be raped, each journey a sudden wave. His touch wore you down to a fugitive eye. The sound of you sucking your thumb at night blows in my ears. All morning, our mother's voice beyond the hills. And I wrote this piece only after my sister made transition in 2004. But if you notice, I read these two together about myself and about my sister, and the last haiku, I repeat the mother's voice beyond the hills, because the mother's voice was always, I've always traveled with my mother's voice. My mother, who died when I was 1 year old, giving birth to twins, and some years later I gave birth to twins. And I remember calling my dad in New York City saying I had given birth to twins. And my father started to cry. No, he started to sob. And it was then that I remembered that my mother had died giving birth to twins. I can say it because I assume that all of you here like poetry, so that's why you're here. You weren't dragged necessarily, although there might be some classes here. You might have been dragged here. But I do hope you like poetry. But I do remember that after I spoken to my dad, I went to sleep. And I remember waking up about 3 o'clock in the morning and someone was calling Sonia, Sonia, Sonia. And I sat up in bed and I said, yes, yes, yes. And this little short nurse was passing by and she backed up and she said, ah, Sanchez, Sanchez, she said, you already caused us some problems giving birth to twins. We expected one baby and we had to find an extra incubator. It was really, and I said, someone's calling me. And she said, oh, girl, no one's calling you. And then because I was sitting up, my gown had sort of come out in front. And she came over to help me stretch out and she said, oh, my God. And she said, go to sleep. And someone had put the IV in wrong. They put it in too fast, and my stomach had hardened. And the thing about that is that's what happened to my mom. My mom's stomach had hardened because she had died in a diabetic coma, and everything had hardened inside of her. And I remember she said, go to sleep. And I remember her hands on my stomach, rubbing my stomach. You know, I do contend, that's why I say all morning, our mother's voice beyond the hills, because I contend that my mom's voice came and said, that too will not happen to you at all, what happened to me. A woman by the name of Odetta made transition last year. I don't know if any of you ever heard Odetta. Anybody? A brilliant, brilliant, brilliant woman. I had the honor of performing with her on numerous occasions, and even when she was ill, you know, she'd sit in a wheelchair. And then she got on stage, and like, you know, she was on stage. It was like nothing was wrong at all. It's just amazing what happens to an artist when he or she gets on stage. 21 Haku for Odetta. 1, the sound of your voice thundering out of the earth, a drum beat summoning us to prayer. Behold the smell of your breathing, dilated by politics you dare to love. You open up your throat to travelers, exhale lead belly on Saturday nights and Sunday mornings. Your music asks, has your song a father or a mother? On stage you were a soldier of hands, accenting beat after beat into beauty. You ask, is there no song that will bring rain to this desert? You unveil your voice at early demonstrations, saluted our blood until we were no longer strangers, waltzed our eyes until we danced from chandeliers. Your songs journeyed in a country padlocked with greed, a country still playing on adolescent knees. Suddenly, the morning takes you back another time, another continent, where stones contacted stars, told us hello and goodbye. Finally, we remember how you gave life to memory. Remember your eyes, morning stars perfumed with rain, your mouth, a sweet wind, painted with hieroglyphics, finally to pass your song into our ancestral rivers. That's a poem for a great woman, Odetta, who helped us stay alive, you know, during the civil rights days and during all those times that, you know, we were trying to stay alive. I was in a place called Guernavaca, with a woman by the name of Elizabeth Catlett, a great artist. And when I go there for one day, I do nothing but sleep. You know, I eat, right? I go out in the garden, and I get on the grass, and I sleep. I come back in, get on the couch, but I listen to music. That's all day, just music, just music. And quite often, I listen to flamenco music, you know? This is called Duende. 1, listening to flamenco music and picturing the dances and watching me sometimes on stage also too. 1, my hands abandon me to bloodletting. My breasts are dancing in silver. My feet are crying blues. My thighs seem the flesh off the guitar. My breath is indecent as my teeth. Ah, yeah, I am still standing, I am still standing, I am still standing. That's a piece that I did from listening. But I used to do it with my feet and stuff, but it's very difficult doing it with your feet behind here, you know? So I'm told that we're going to have a Q&A, and that I'm in to read for 30 minutes, and I've been reading for 30 minutes and stuff and whatever, and maybe people have questions and whatever. I'd like to end up with this piece to Max Roach, the great, great percussionist drummer, a man that I played with on many occasions. And, you know, we were playing at the San Francisco Opera House once, and we've been on the road with this piece with a three groups, a Latino group, an Asian group, and African-American group, and we played about three colleges, you know, and had it really down and straight, and we got to San Francisco in the morning. We got in there early in the morning, and we went right to rehearsals to the opera house, and we did this thing, and we said, got it. Then we went to the hotel, went to sleep, you know, artists would go to sleep. Sleep is the most important thing. Got a little food and came back. And I got there, and I got on stage, and we were the last. The rest of the people went on and did, and we were the last to perform. And I got up and I said, introduce and say, and this is the great Max Roach, and he was behind me under the drums, you know, whatever. And we rehearsed this thing, so Max was supposed to, you know, like, I would say, like, one, and Max started to play, you know. And so I turned around and watched him play, you know. Oh, and he started to play, and he played, and he played, and he played, and he played. And I'm waiting, and finally it dawned on me that Max did not want to do what we had rehearsed. You know, Max wanted to do what he wanted to do, an improvisation thing, you know. So I'm standing there, and I finally said, Max, Max, is that Max? Max Roach? You know, and when we did that all the way, like whatever came out of the head, then he was ready to do the thing we had rehearsed. But for a moment, I tell you, I stood there petrified, and I'm looking at, you know, 4,000 people looking, you know, thinking, looking at him out of the corner of my eye, figuring he's going to stop eventually, right? But that's the great thing with working with artists and musicians, because they will do that to you, you know, and you will learn really how to be a poet on stage, okay? You'll learn how to be something on stage, you know, a dancer, you know, a swimmer, or something, but you'll learn. And that's the joy of that. The last one, the 10th haiku, they inscribed on his tombstone at a place called Woodlawn. But it's quite an honor. But if you ever go to Woodlawn Cemetery, and sometimes we should make a trek up there, you know, Illinois Jacquette is there, Duke Ellington, and the great Miles. In fact, Miles requested to be buried right next to Duke Ellington. So they're right next to each other. I mean, it's just an amazing, amazing thing to see. Gosh, of course, Max and two other people are missing. And the great Cuban singer, Celia Cruz, is there too. In fact, Celia has, she and her husband, they have this huge place. And we were looking at it, Maxine Roach and I were looking at it, saying that times really continue to be tough, you know. People can move in there, you know. I mean, it is big, you know. Like, you know, we kept looking in, right, you know, like, you know, figuring out you could put a TV there and a little Bunsen burner also, too. But I'm being facetious, but, I mean, there were some huge ones there, you know, and just amazing. But all those musicians, and you can imagine when you leave there at night, the kind of jazz thing that they do at night when you leave. And Max was added to that. 10 haiku for Max Roach. 1, nothing ends, every blade of grass, remembering your sound. Your sounds exploding in the universe, return to earth in prayer. As you drum, your hands kept reaching for God, God, the morning sky so lovely imitates your laughter. You came, warrior clear, your music kissing our spines, feet tapping, singing in peach, our blood You came drumming sweet life on sails of flesh. Your fast feet riding the air settles in our bones. Your drums soloing our breaths unto the beat, unbeat, unto the beat, unbeat, unto the beat, unbeat. Your hands shimmering on the legs of rain. Your hands. On the legs of rain. Max Roach.
So we've got folks with mics in the aisles. If you'd like to ask a question, just raise your hand. I'll call on you and we'll please wait for the mic right in front here.
First and foremost, let me thank you for blessing us with your presence.
Oh,
and,
thank you, my dear sister. What's
you,
your name?
Rhonda.
Rhonda.
And you mentioned a place, Guinevega?
Cuernavaca.
Cuernavaca.
In
can
Mexico.
Oh, okay. I was going to ask you if you could tell us where it was because you made it sound like paradise when you said you eat and you sleep.
Oh, well, this house is paradise, actually. She has three houses on property. The big house, you know, and then she has another house for one of her sons. Stays, and she has a smaller house where you can go and retreat if you want to write. But I used to stay in the big house with her, you know. Sister Elizabeth's 94 now, you know, and she's the one who does a fantastic sculpture, you know, in every major museum. She has a piece of sculpture in it, so you should hunt it down sometimes, right? But it's a place that you go for, you know, for rest and you know, you get up. I went there one year. I was so beat up and tired from the year that I actually went to bed maybe about 9 o'clock, and she came knocking on the door about 9 o'clock. I slept straight through. I hadn't slept 12 hours in so many, you know, days. And, you know, but Elizabeth also at 94 works. So I figured I'm coming down here to rest. So I'm going to get on a couch, go outside on the grass, you know, wallow in the grass, you know, go in the swimming pool and swim, you know, do all those good things. And then I came back in and had the music on. I was just listening, and she's inside working. And she says, Sonia. I said, yes. She said, when are you going to start writing? So you might be there, right, you know, but you end up working and writing, you know. I finished something down there 1 year, you know, so, yeah. But it is a beautiful, beautiful place. Thank you, my sister.
Another one right in front here.
Again, peace and blessings, sister.
Thank you.
Victoria. I want to take you back in time. I know you've spoken like probably hundreds of thousands, possibly millions of times. I don't even know if you've kept count of all the times you've spoken and maybe all the people that you've touched.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. But I want you to, if you can briefly share with us a time when you were so rocked by the audience or the scenario, a time when it really, like, really reached down. And I mean, you're a feeling woman, obviously, you know, and I grew up in New York, so I know what you mean about talking bad and walking through the streets, and, you know, it's not always about good morning, it's not, but a time when your soul was really touched by a place that you spoke at, or a person you spoke to, or a time when it just, something that you know you'll never forget. Can you share one of those times with us?
I've had a number of times like that where you have read and people just stood up stamping their feet, rocking a house. That was at a place in San Francisco at the very beginning at Fillmore. you know, thousands of people in there. I was there with some other poets, and that really happened. And I remember that because of the kind of energy of young people, you know, black, brown, white, green people, you know, in there, mostly young people in there. I could tell you that, and I don't mean this in a disrespectful way, but there's no audience like a New York audience. And I mean that. I mean, it's an interesting audience that, you know, you get up and what they do, you open your mouth and there is like something that happens there, and it's just an amazing moment. And that has happened to me at a number of places, from NYU, Columbia University, Symphony Hall, a lot of places, you know, there. Out the country when I was in Nicaragua, and the people there who love poetry, even though they were translating, we came to this place and it was a stadium, and people walked in and sat down. It's a packed stadium, just unbelievable, you know. And as they translated, there was the roar from the crowd, you know, which was an amazing moment. And the Royal something in London, what is that? Royal Hall in London, where it was a poetry festival, and I think I was the last person to read, and so people were really kind of like there. And that connection, it doesn't matter where you are, what language people can truly understand. And just last year in Brussels, I got into a place and they had these musicians who were there, who were going to play. And they were Asian musicians, African musicians. They come from all over the world. And they came up and said, "Would you read with us, Professor Sanchez?" And I immediately said, "We don't know each other." I was being facetious. And they laughed. They said, "Well, we'll play some stuff for you." And then I thought about, hey, we've done this with jazz musicians before. And we got on that stage and we walked those poems across that stage. And people gave them and myself a standing ovation. But it's not what I'm trying to do now, in a very real sense, is that I'm trying very much to have that emotion remain in your heart and your stomach and not necessarily in your hands. Because we clap very easily. We clap for people who curse us out. We clap for people, you know, who say they love us. We clap for people who say they don't love us. You know, we clap for everything. But when we clap, we don't hear. So one of the things I'm trying to do with young people is to say, if you start up here with a poem, you have no place else to go. Right, right. We're so accustomed to now the noise of a piece that we don't hear always what's inside. That we really, we know, we hear it and we start clapping before the person says anything else. You know, I mean, I'm there. I know I've judged a million of these things, you know. Mm-hmm. And so at some point I say to young people, you know, that it's a very wise country, that it keeps us involved always with noise. And never the quiet. And the haku mind makes us involve ourselves with the quiet. The quiet that's inside, you know. So the quiet that goes back and forth amongst us at some point, you know. Hear that, you know. Your hands shimmering on the legs of rain. Your hands shimmering on the legs of rain, you know. Silence there. Silence to listen, to let it go inside the bloodstream and penetrate the bloodstream. To tell young people that if you scream, so you don't understand what it means sometimes to understand the sunlight or the sunset if we're screaming. And it is a country that has taught us so much about being what I call, people who listen to everything that everyone's doing, you know, on the idiot box, you know. We're always, you know, voyeurs, you know, like who slept with whom, you know, and who's doing what with whom, you know, and why did they do it, and how long have they been doing it, whatever, you know. And we don't ever, it's a place now that keeps us involved with everything below the waist. everything below the waist. I want you involved with the stomach and everything below the waist. But everything above the waist, the heart, and this, you know, the mind, the intellect, no way, you know. Yeah. And it's a country that is involving us always with everything below the waist, from food to sex and sex and food and sex and food and food and sex and you name it, whatever. And so if you keep people involved with stuff like that, then how can they get involved at any point, you know, with your heart, with whether people are starving, you know? You do it in ways sometimes that if there's a big disaster, you send money, you know? You'll send money. We will send money. I text some money, telephone, whatever. But don't let them come in the country. Because before, if you've ever climbed the Citadel in Haiti, and I've climbed that Citadel, and I heard Desaline, you know, I heard him. I heard him, you know, I heard him defending a country. I heard in the Western Hemisphere, the first country that ever fought for liberty and won it. But for the last 20 years in America, all we've heard is boat people, boat people, boat people, don't let them in. Boat people, don't let them in. They're boat people. They got AIDS. Boat people, don't let them in. You know? And I don't think we need disasters to see humanity in people or to feel sorry for people, you know? You know, what I'm trying to bring our young people back is that looking at each other. And one of the first exercises I do with them is that I make them face each other in a circle, and I make them put their right hand on their partner's heart, and their partner will put right hand on heart, and then I put my left hand on my partner's heart, and they put the left hand on my heart, and we listen to each other's heartbeat. That's what I'm doing with the haiku. The haiku is a heartbeat, people. It keeps you alive. There's nothing wild in it. There could be some things that are wild, suggestive, but nothing wild in it. It says, stay alive. Hear the heartbeat. Hear the heartbeat. So they hear each other's heartbeat. And those kids in school said, oh, I heard a heartbeat. And I said, yeah, now you can't hurt her. Now you can't talk about it in a workshop. That you only deal with her work, not how she looked, how she be, what she got on, what she don't got on, what her hair looks like. You got to hear that. If you hear nothing else in the city of Philadelphia, I've been here how many years? Moved here in 76. In a city that we still have the kind of poverty that we have in this city. And we still have these things of saying that in the city of Philadelphia, in Pennsylvania, we got people, children going to bed hungry. Hungry. And this is one of the most, all these colleges and universities here. And people teach and don't take their students out into the community. You talk with me, your behind was in the community. You know, you had to deal with what was going on in the world, you know. I always sat many years ago with Father Paul Washington and can't think of the brother who was a minister over at Temple. Dave Richardson and a minister over at Temple. He's dead now. What's his?
Dave Gracie.
They invited the four of us. Listen to that. The city invited the four of us to come in and talk about how do you look at Philadelphia, the educational system, right, the government, whatever. You know, could you come and talk? We stayed there the whole bloody day. Someone take that. I used to ask everybody, whatever happened to those tapes? We thought outrageously about education, not in the lines, but outside the lines, right? You know, whatever. Because that's what we need to do now. We need to think outrageously about a city that still has this kind of poverty. The same kind of poverty that I saw when I moved here years ago, it still exists. And we've had mayor after mayor after mayor after mayor after mayor after mayor after mayor. And we built some magnificent stadiums for people to play ball in, you know. But what about the magnificent houses for people, human beings, you know, to live? Huh? And so I'm teaching our children how to hear each other's heartbeat. So in the classroom, they will not hit each other. They won't even think about hurting each other. All they know is that if you can hear a heartbeat and that heartbeat can go around the room, then you got a class where people can act like human beings towards each other. Not mad at each other, not competing with each other, but being in a classroom with each other. Remember no poem I say. Do that. One of my students went home and did it with her mother and heard her heartbeat was skipping a beat and took her to emergency, and she had a bad heart. So we need to do it with our children too. We need to like go and listen to each other's heartbeat. And that, you know, hope I answered your question.
Time for a few more right here, and then we'll move in back a little.
Hi, Sister Senya. I'm really pleased to be here and to hear you in person again.
Yes.
Would you share with the audience, walk away to have another day?
Right. That's the thing that I did for, thank you, my sister. That's the thing. What's your name?
Mary.
And the other person, what was your name? Someone else.
Victoria.
Yes. Did I answer your question, Sister Victoria?
Oh, absolutely.
Brother Talib Kweli was with me. You know, he asked me, would you be on my CD? I said, are you kidding? You must be kidding, right? Right. But I was doing that with him to talk about, and I wish I had that piece, but you know, this is, you know, about this book right here. But that piece has never been published. But I talk about walking away to have another day. What I said to young people is that it was very hard for me when I know someone is very cruel, is saying something to me in a very cruel fashion, right? You know, we're not crazy. We hear it. You know, we know when it's happening, right? You know, now once upon a time, I would have listened to that kind of cruelty and said, and kept on walking, you know? Because that's how we respond, isn't it? Most of the time, well, you're trying to be smart, right? You know, well, let me tell you what I really think about you, right? But now, I said, I'm so sorry, my sister. Can you tell me how I offended you? Because please excuse me. I must have offended you in some way for you to say what you said, you know? And that's what I'm saying. So I'm teaching. So one of the young brothers said to me, Professor Sanchez, though, someone to think you're a punk. I said, well, people are going to think whatever they want to think anyway. Hey, you know what I mean? That's not your problem, right? Your problem, what you know is that who you are. If you know you're not a punk, no one else can make you a punk, right? Isn't that so? You know, whatever. I said, but what you can do is stay alive. And nowadays, since this country sells guns to anybody, you know, whatever, it means you have to go and do a whole lot of cautionary things to stay alive, whatever. And one of the things you can do is to back away, you know, and say, excuse me. I mean, like in the piece I say, so you stepped on my shoes, made them look like the blues. I'm going to kill them, kill them, kill them, kill them, kill them, kill them. Because one of the rap things, they talk about stepping on a blue suede shoes and killing somebody. You know, so I did it, you know, with Talib. You gotta kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him, kill him. So he looked at your girl, made her look like a pearl. You gotta kill him, kill him, kill him. People be killing people about. So when I read it, these young kids, well, how you know about that? Because they think we don't know anything. You know, you got gray hair. How could you know? You know what I mean? Whatever, et cetera. Yeah. But everything, I said to these young people, I said, everything you do, we've done. Ain't nothing new. The only thing that we didn't complete was changing the sucker. And that's up to some of you to do also, too. So that's it's a long poem, you know. And I say in it, you know, like, it's a long poem, you know, whatever. But I start off that way, you know, it's contract with life, not death. And so that's what I've been doing all over. Now, what's interesting about all this, you do know that I go to the gig, I come back a year later, I have to make that on my own. So I have to get cheap tickets to get there because no one's sending me back to that state the next time around. But I go back and I was, I don't know where I was, someplace, and this young sister came up and said, you know you're coming to Atlanta. And I looked at her and I said, I knew I was due there like in September. So I said, oh, yeah, yeah. She said, because we were saying maybe she won't come back. You know, and I said, oh, no, I'm going to get there. I said, I'm going to get a cheap ticket and get there. These young people will track you down, will stalk you to make sure you show up, you know. I was someplace, you know, and that's what they did. That's what we have to do. We are responsible. I watch people always embracing the young people who are so good, who do everything right. Those are our children. But I say all of these are our children, the ones who don't do right. They're our children, too. You know, these are our children, and we've made them what they are, you know. So we can't just say only the ones excelling are our children. All of these are our children, and we got to remember that. Yeah. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Thank you for that question, my sister.
Mm-hmm. Good evening.
How you doing, my sister?
Here to say how much we love you and how happy we are that you're teaching us and that you continue to teach us all of the world. Mm-hmm. And every time that I see you, you just bring so much joy to my heart. I've heard you speak in Paris, mm-hmm. and I've mm-hmm. seen you walk the streets of Paris, and people are just as familiar with her as they are here in Philadelphia. So it just brings me such joy to see her teaching our children and teaching all of us, and to just let her know how much we love her. And thank you so much for being you.
Thank you, my sister. Thank you. Appreciate that.
Unfortunately, we only have time for a couple of more. Let's move. Nancy, if we could go back on your left. There's
we can rebel if we want to. I'm sorry.
Peace, Mama Sanchez.
Yeah, peace to you too, my brother.
My name is Derek Washington, and I was a student of yours at Temple University some years ago.
Oh, gosh.
I'm sure you wouldn't remember me, but that's okay. That's okay. You really influenced my life a lot.
Thank you.
And when I was in Temple, I was floundering. I mean, I had to fight just to take your class. And I fought silently but strongly, and I was able to do it. And my question is, I believe you were very prominent in the 60s, and I see a lot of analogous now to revolution, to power in the people, and the people need to organize, and like the earth is changing, and the position of the earth is changing, and all these things. And I just feel like people really, we are in a revolution of consciousness right now, and I just wanted to hear some of your thoughts on that.
Well, we've been in one for a long, long time, you know. What we had to learn is that we, coming out of the 60s, that we were not inventing everything. We thought we were. We thought like this had never been talked about before by anyone until we began to study, and that people had done it in the 30s and 20s and at the turn of the century and even in the 19th century. Right? Come on, people. If you read David Walker's Appeal, you know, then you go, whoa. When my students first read it in a lit class, they said, was this written yesterday? And I said, well, you know, some yesterday, right? Yeah. So, you know, what we really truly know at some point, my dear brother, is that one of the things that we did in the 60s is that we alerted the country to the fact that finally we have found out some things about the country and we wanted to change it. And we did it in a very loud fashion. I was telling someone in an interview recently that, you know, it couldn't be done. We couldn't say, well, you know what, by golly, by gee, I just found out that we were enslaved. You know, people would have looked at you like, well, right, really, you know. So we did it in a loud voice, you know. There were people here in Philly like Larry Neal, people like Charlie Fuller. I'm missing a lot of what's the newspaper person James Spady, you know, who is one of the really most amazing public intellectuals, I think, here in this place called Philadelphia, if you read him. You know, there were people who were writing some fantastic things here in this place called Philadelphia. And then going up to New York, there were people up there also, too, from Baraka, you know, from a bunch of us, Turay, you know, we were all up there doing some work, very important work. What we were saying at the point is that we were very much concentrated on ourselves and our people, saying, we have come out and learned that we've been enslaved by golly, by gee, watch out, people. You know, so everybody, you know, we took pot shots at everybody, family even, fathers, mothers, didn't matter. You know, we just said, you really don't know. You didn't do anything. That's youth speaking. Youth. And it's allowed. When I hear a lot of youth, you know, when you hear a lot of the rappers sometimes saying stuff, that's youth. You know, and I lean back on my eyes and say, yeah, okay, I'm going to talk about some other things. You can move to another level, okay? So we did, and it was very important to have done it because in the midst of all of that, we also moved and started things. We began things, you know, the Black Arts Repertory Theater, Black Studies in a place called San Francisco, and we went around to various universities and started at a place called University of Pitt. And it wasn't my idea. I'm not a revisionist. But, you know, I was on campus at University of Pitt, and my students, mostly women, used to come and gather in my office. And I said, I got to get home to my children. And I said offhandedly, you know, sometimes I think we need a course. That was offhanded. You never say anything offhanded to your students, right? You know, B.B. Moore Campbell was one of the students there at that time, a fine writer, right? And the next day I showed up at 8 o'clock in the morning. They were lined up outside my office and said, you're right. You're right. We should have a course and you should teach it. Let me tell you about students, right? This mic is messing a little bit. So I said, okay. We'll do it. But, you know, University of Pitt was on quarters. We were in a quarter already. It meant that you had to come up with something right away for the next quarter. So we were sitting in my office. I said, well, we'll call it what? And we kept saying, finally said, together, the Black woman. And so I sent upstairs to the powers that be. Let's have a course. I want to do a course on the Black woman, right? And they sit back down like 2 minutes later, like, we've never had a course on the Black woman. We never had a course on the woman. We never had a course on men. We never had a course on anything like that. And then they said, at the end of that, what books would you use? Ah, I had the books. Sent back upstairs, whatever. And we did it. And the next quarter, we're walking to something very new, people. A course called The Black Woman. I figured only women would be coming in the course, right? I got in there were 35 men and 35 women looking at me. And then there were the administrators sitting around three strong with pads, writing before we even started. And I'm a young teacher now, new teacher, right? I got all my notes out, right? Never veer from my notes, right? I'm behind the desk, right? You know, whatever. We started handing out the syllabus, boom, boom, boom. Everything's fine. The second week, this young woman stood up and said, I hate all Black men. And I came back to my syllabus. There was nothing that said, I hate all Black men. And I said, oh. And I mean, I came from behind the desk. I went and held her because she was crying. The whole class held her. Incest. I went back and indicated on there the insertion incest. I got to go the weekend, research everything that's written on it because I got to put it in here, whatever. You learn so much by teaching, you know. And I came back. We got help for her, of course, basic stuff, whatever. And then about a week and a half later, this young Black man said, I hate all Black women. I said, oh, no. And the administrators were writing. I mean, they were just writing. They were taking notes furiously, right? And that was about his mother never, ever, ever allowed him to go out at night. She was patting him on the head, keeping him from being a man. And we dealt with all of that, whatever. But my dear brothers and my dear sisters, what that was all about, too, was that those young women knew that they could not survive on that campus without something that was very formal that made them begin to study themselves to see how they had gotten to a point called Pitt, University of Pitt, You know, in 1969, they had to get a history in order to stay alive, because they would not have made it. You got to hear that. And I had to do the research for that also, too. And that was, like, an amazing thing. And I had to, like, I went to sleep with that course on my head, on my brain, people. And in the middle of the night, I get up making notes, right? We read literature, and I tried to figure out how can I do two things in here. That is, explain this literature we're reading other than, like, thematically. You know, we're taught, you know, to teach this stuff thematically, you know, in this university. But it wasn't working, right? And so I'm reading stuff like Clotel with them, right? You know, if you haven't read it, read it. Clotel. And we're seeing men and women. And we're seeing women deciding, looking at black men secondarily. So I discovered something called secondary consciousness. I wrote about black women started to look at black men secondarily through the eyes of the slave master. You have no idea how that explained literature to us, but how it explains also, you know, a lot of the modern day literature written by women. Come on. You have to understand that, you know. It explains the bluest eye, you know. And the woman working in the kitchen, right, huh? And she comes home and looks at her husband and says, why can't he take care of me the way Mr. Fisher takes care of whatever, et cetera. Secondary consciousness. But also there was a big section, right, called patriarchy and matriarchy, right? And one brother said to me in class, I can't wait until we get to this section, because Monahan had just put out his report. Remember? The Monahan report. If you don't remember, you're too young. Go read it. You need to read it. And the Monahan report said everything that was wrong in the black community came from black women. You know, so they were laying for that because they were ready to say that's true, whatever. And getting up to that part, I had dreams. I mean, literally dreams. And I woke up in the middle of the night and I wrote diarchy. And I said, black families basically have not been matriarchal or patriarchal because they both pretend some kind of power. But the way we were enslaved in this place called America is diarchal. You know, we either had an uncle in there or a grandmother in there, whatever. But a diarchy means you're under attack. And we've been under attack, so we could not assume those roles that people were talking about, you know, matriarchy, patriarchy. You got to hear that also, too. That's what happens when you teach. So all those things surface as I taught, my dear brother, you know. And the things that we have not gotten to finally at this particular point is that we really don't want to deal with a number of things now. You know, that is that there are poor people in a place called America, that racism still goes on in a place called America and the world, right? Whatever. And it's like every generation comes along and they smile. It's like, you know, it's like there's dirt there, you know, and we put talcum powder on it. And it smells so sweetly sweet for about a decade. And then we keep walking on it, and then all of a sudden the smell comes up. And someone says, my golly, by gee, what is that smell there? They say, it's racism. It's poverty. You know, it's sexism. Huh? You know? You know, huh? It's that 1% who rule the world. You know. That's what we finally see. And we got to deal. I'm talking to the young people now. You got to deal with, you got to break with old ideas. You got to break with those ideas. You got to break with the ideas that will keep a city like Philadelphia from progressing the way it should progress. This should be a major city. We keep going from fourth to fifth. You know what I mean? I'm waiting for us to hit the sixth, you know. And that's only happening because we're not dealing with who we are, finally. You know, we're not teaching our children, you know. We really aren't, you know. Like, come right in to my class and stay here and you'll be okay. What about the other class? Whatever. What about them? Huh? You know, what about people looking at each other in an equal fashion? I know the trouble I had in Philadelphia, someone told me, I'll never forget it, English department, said to me, the problem with you, Sonia, you come in and you talk to people as an equal. I thought, yeah, that's the deal, right? But I heard what the person was telling me. Make no mistake about it. And what we must do as black and white and green and brown and yellow is to begin to talk to each other as an equal. Not like we're scared all the time. But, you know, not that we're scared, whatever. We got to do that finally. And that's important. That's important actually for our survival, for this earth survival. You know, it will not survive this lukewarm stuff that's going on in the world. It will not survive it, people, you know. And so I'm saying to young people, you should be really upset at some point about people saying if we don't get, you know, this thing correct about this global warming, that maybe you have 15 years. Now, if I were 16 years of age, I'd be pissed to think that maybe I'm only going to make it to 31. I mean, really. So one of the things I call for in a place called Atlanta is that I called for us to write a letter, to draft a letter to our president, to talk about a youth congress in a place called D.C. to begin to teach young people how to organize, you know, how to write all kinds of things, you know, press releases, right? How to win an election. Because we need to send some of those old guys in Congress home. Oh, we do. We do. We do. We do. We really do. They need to go home. Like, you've been here too long. You know, way too long. That's right. You know, and we need also to begin to understand that we voted and worked very hard for this president right here. But he cannot do this sucker by himself. You know, and you can't lean back and say, oh, he's not doing what I want him to do. Well, that's right. You know, because as Roosevelt said, you know, like, make me do it. You know, when he talked, when the black people said to him, we want, you know, integration in the armies, will make me do it. We got to make people do things. Okay. They're not going to do it on their own. They are finally politicians, people. You know? And that's what we have to do. We can't lean back and complain. Lean forward and do something. Lean forward and do something.
Ladies and gentlemen, Sonia Sanchez. Thank you for listening to a podcast from the Free Library's Author Event Series. If you live in Philadelphia or are planning a visit and would like to attend an author event, information is available at freelibrary.org.